All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Tuesday, February 28th. It's another beautiful day on Lake Wissota. We had some big, fat, fluffy snowflakes for a while in the afternoon, but otherwise rain. None of the snow really stuck, and so we are happy to have dodged that one. But there's another storm never far away because, again, winter in Wisconsin. Nice to have you along. Coming up this morning, we're going to talk about Jim Obergefell's fight for your rights. It was the U.S. Supreme Court's 2015 ruling in the case of Obergefell v. Hodges that led to national recognition for the legality of same-sex marriage. Jim Obergefell didn't set out to be a civil rights pioneer. It's simply that his partner was dying and he wanted their union to have the same respect and rights that they deserved. And we share an excerpt from a recent interview that he did as part of a podcast hosted by Kirk Bankstead over at the Managua Brewing Company. Now, also the reasons why rural Wisconsin needs Tony Evers' budget. There is a lot to love in that proposal for Wisconsin's rural economy. And it's not just the investments in roads and bridges and broadband and schools, but also the targeted help that's in there for increasing farm exports, modernizing dairy processing plants, helping food pantries stay stocked with fresh Wisconsin-grown products. And we will talk to Lincoln County farmer Hans Breitenmoser live in our second hour about that. Also, about an hour from now, with Election Day now 5 weeks from today, we'll look back on our interview with Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz and her campaign for a seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll check in later with weatherology meteorologist Jennifer Pachitsky. And in the Civic Media homeroom, we will have Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio along. As usual, we'd be happy to have you joining us as well. We've got a couple of phone numbers that you can use, 844-967-2789 or 715-388-7155. And you can email us anytime, radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And Aaron Zommers will take those calls in Madison. Mr. Zommers, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
We are, we talked a bit about this yesterday, but now we finally posted it up on Facebook. And I don't know, maybe it's not right that we're starting with Girl Scout cookies so early in the morning, Aaron, but I wouldn't say no to them if there was a box here.
I don't think starting with Girl Scout cookies is ever wrong.
No, and if it is, I don't want to be right. So we had the uplift yesterday, our new Monday segment with Christina Laurie, where we talked about it being Girl Scout cookie time and that there's actually a way to get Girl Scout cookies, order them online, and it would still benefit the local Girl Scouts in your area. I believe it's girlscoutcookies.org. And so we also asked what's your favorite and what new flavors would you create. So we've given you a couple of places on Facebook where you could do that. You can either on Facebook go to the Up North News page, and we have that as a separate post, that question, along with a nice picture of Girl Scout cookies. Or you could put your comments on the post where you can watch this radio show live through a video feed. And by the way, if you are at the Up North News page on Facebook or on the Bull Falls Radio Facebook page out of Wausau, or the Civic Media Facebook page, that look up Civic Media US, you can put your comments right there, and we may put those up on screen as part of the video feed for what we do here. So we'd love to have you along, get your favorite cookies, and also the ones you'd invent. That one strikes me as having tremendous potential, not just for the really good stuff people would put together, but you know, the things that you might not think of and maybe shouldn't think of, like a pork chop flavored cookie or whatever the case may be. Whenever you're going to have that cookie, you're going to want a big old glass of milk with it. Are you going to want that glass of milk to be milk, or are you going to want that to be what they call almond milk or oat milk or soy milk? Where any of those milk alternatives, Aaron, are they in the Zommers and roommates refrigerator?
I definitely am a fan of oat milk. I used to work at Starbucks, and when I did, I got to try all these alternative milks in various drinks, and I felt that the creaminess of oat milk really made it seem the most similar. but also gave it something different to be enjoyed over normal dairy.
Well, I'm sure we will talk about this with Hans Breitenmoser in our next hour as well, but it's worth mentioning whether these products should be calling themselves milk when, you know, milk is something that comes from mammals. You're not milking little oat flakes. You're not milking little almonds. It's, you know, you're crushing it and extracting something and adding water or whatever you do. But anyway, the Food and Drug Administration recently drafted some new federal rules that would allow plant-based milk alternative products to continue to call themselves milk. And needless to say, Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin was among those who criticized the FDA and said, look, milk is milk, and that's the way it should be. And as she wrote to the FDA, she included a screenshot of the Oxford Language Dictionary definition of milk, again, pointing out that it must come from mammals. And so it leads to this question. Is oat milk milk? Would you keep the word milk in there, or should they not be allowed to because of the harm it does to the people who actually make milk, our Wisconsin dairy farmers?
I mean, personally,
yeah,
just like she said, yeah, it isn't milk factually, so I wouldn't be opposed to a different name. I don't know what we'd call it. Maybe if, like, oat juice sounds really weird too.
Well, you could use beverage, you could use drink, you know, because for example, juice. You know, if something doesn't have juice, you can't call it juice, or you got to be realistic about the percentage of juice that's in there. So, you know, we're going to talk more about whether there should be more honest labeling in our food products. Let's take a break and take a look at some other headlines around Wisconsin coming up next. You're up north. We're going to tell you all a bit about the Star Wars Cantina band known as CPAC and why more Republicans are not attending that, shall we say, colorful place coming up in just a bit. But first, I wanted to let you know that coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to have former state treasurer Sarah Godlewski. She's going to talk about some rallies that she and a consortium of groups are putting together. There will be at least a half a dozen of these rallies coming up throughout March in the state of Wisconsin for people who would like to express their support for their freedom, to make their own choices about their own bodies and about their own health care. And so Sarah will tell us more about that tomorrow morning. We're also going to talk to Kyle Kaminsky. He's a colleague of mine with Courier Newsroom. He works for their Michigan outlet, The Gander. And he is their leading journalist on matters related to marijuana and legalized pot. And the reason for that is that Michigan legalized marijuana 4 years ago. So he is in a unique position to tell a Wisconsin audience what that experience has been like. Has it been a net positive, a negative? What is Michigan getting that Wisconsin is not getting by its decision to legalize marijuana, whereas Wisconsin is basically an outlier when it comes to marijuana still being illegal in all circumstances? We're not getting the tax revenue. We're not regulating the sale of it. And so Kyle will talk about that with us. That, of course, is, again, that's coming up tomorrow. A reminder that there are many ways to catch what we do here. You can go to civicmedia.us and subscribe to us as a podcast, and you can get that on all of the places where you normally get your podcast, Apple, Spotify, and whatnot. I wanted to touch briefly again on something that was mentioned yesterday, and that was Congressman Tom Tiffany's letter to the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Really throwing sand in the gears of working toward an agreement so that non-tribal members who have individual parcels of land inside the reservation can still access it. And if you missed it yesterday, we gave a brief history of why there is this Swiss cheese setup of individual pieces of land in a reservation owned by non-tribal members. And of course, you know, it's Congress. In this case, Congress back in 1887 cleared the way for that to happen. And so to get to those individual parcels of land, non-tribal members, of course, have to go through the reservations in some way, shape, or form. And that's trespassing. That's sovereign land for those tribes. And so you negotiate a corridor or something called an easement so that the, you know, the tribe, if they wish, is compensated for that access. And those agreements existed for many years, but the most recent ones expired in 2010. And since that time, there's been a lot of foot dragging to reach an agreement. And so the Lac des Flambeaux have gone uncompensated for those easements. And finally, basically to force the issue, they've put blockades on the roads so that, you know, non-tribal members have to, you know, find alternative means to get to their homes. It's not something that you necessarily want to do to your neighbor, but at some point, the federal government's Bureau of Indian Affairs has to get off the schneid here and start taking this issue seriously, providing the information that can facilitate an agreement between the town of Lac des Flambeaux and the Lac des Flambeaux tribal community. So again, this is a case where you want negotiations, you want information. If there's pressure that should be put on anybody, it should be on the federal government. And if there's anybody that you could count on to take a whack at the federal government, it would be the congressman from up north, Tom Tiffany. But instead, perhaps not surprisingly, his letter was full of venom toward the Lac des Flambeaux tribe. Instead, saying that their actions to force this issue, quote, look less like a negotiation and more like an extortion racket. He called the tribe's payment request a shakedown and a demand for ransom from vulnerable town residents. And while Tiffany does call out the Bureau of Indian Affairs for this foot dragging, his conclusion contains a threat to the tribe. Quote, the longer the roadblocks remain in place, the more likely policymakers will be to pursue a legislative option, which is, you know, just code for, you know, knuckle under, or all these, you know, white guys in Congress on the Republican side are going to take some kind of action to, you know, make it easier to perhaps take more of your land, or whatever it is that he's trying to imply from these threats. But given that he's probably of the same mindset as Congress was back in 1887, it's not the world's biggest surprise. But I wanted to point out really the vitriol in his letter to say that the congressperson from that area could be doing more to make the situation better rather than, you know, lobbing verbal grenades. Let's take a look at sports at 6:21. A lot of it is previews. It was a quiet day yesterday. The Marquette men's basketball team can clinch the Big East title outright by winning either tonight at Butler or on Saturday at home against St. John's. The Golden Eagles have won 9 of their last 10 games. The Badger men's basketball team has 2 games left in their regular season, Thursday at home against Purdue, and then next Sunday at Minnesota. And then that's all followed by the Big Ten tournament, which will be probably their only path to the NCAA tournament. The Bucks are in Brooklyn tonight to take on the Nets, and they have a 14-game winning streak that's on the line. Brewers, of course, still continuing their spring training and the regular season that opens on March 30th. All right, I mentioned that CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, that is a... it's been a regular thing for a number of years now, and it may have started, like so many things, it may have started with the intention of being a place for conservatives to go and rub elbows and discuss policy ideas. Somewhere along the line, as more and more extremism has been tolerated in the Republican Party, CPAC itself has become more and more extreme, to the point where recently the conference welcomed the wannabe dictator of Hungary, the authoritarian there, Viktor Orban, who has done so much to, well, basically he's done everything that it looks like Ron DeSantis wants to do in terms of pressuring or even shutting down universities, running roughshod over government agencies that are supposed to be independent, bullying, intimidating, and scaring away a free press. That's everything that's in the authoritarian playbook. It's the kind of thing that Donald Trump would have liked to have done, but he's so ham-handed that he couldn't do nearly as much with it as he wanted to. Does that mean that conservatives are saying, okay, maybe we shouldn't do those things? No. they're saying, well, Trump was just too much of an amateur about it. Now look at how, you know, look how Ron DeSantis has basically taken over governance of Disney World. Look at all of the empty school libraries in Florida, because the books aren't banned, but there is such a process to go through to have books okayed that those libraries are apt to stay empty for a while this long process of examining each book and having it prove its worthiness is processed. So it's really tough for a kid to get their hands on a library book. On a gun, easy as ever, which, you know, tells you about the priorities. But again, that's what we're seeing from a rather extreme, you know, Republican Party and a right wing that, you know, shows itself at places like CPAC. But again, the show, the circus is getting more circus-like all the time. And there are plenty of Republicans who this year have decided they're not showing up to CPAC, which begins tomorrow in suburban Washington, D.C., in Maryland. Some of the big names include Florida Governor DeSantis, former Vice President Mike Pence, the other top GOP leaders in Congress. Now, it's not all political. Part of it is the optics as well. And because CPAC's chair, a guy named Matt Schlapp, is currently defending himself against a lawsuit that alleges that he inappropriately fondled a male aide to then Senate candidate Herschel Walker in Georgia in October without the aide's consent. Schlapp's lawyers say that he denies having committed any kind of sexual battery, but it has led to an exodus of potential, you know, VIPs who would be there, but of course not Donald Trump, because, you know, if you don't mind going to a place that has potential sexual predators in mind, why wouldn't Trump be there? Now, none of the politicians declining to attend have cited the allegations as a reason for their absence, according to a report from NBC News, but several Republicans speaking anonymously said that it was a factor in a broader movement away from the conference. DeSantis, of course, is gearing up for a presidential campaign launch, and so he's been talking more about the obligatory book, you know, that candidates put out before they run for president. But the others who are skipping aren't necessarily running for president, but they're still big names. They include Rona McDaniel, the chair of the National Republican Party, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a rising conservative star as well. A person familiar with Rona McDaniel, who has spoken at CPAC before, would not elaborate. In the past, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, has been listed as a sponsor of CPAC, and this year it is not. And again, for a variety of reasons, not just the accusations against Mr. Schlapp, but also, frankly, if you looked at the midterm results, the extreme right-wing views in this country are on the way down, the support for them. We saw it in any place where there wasn't active gerrymandering in place. You had midterm elections where Democrats who hold the White House should have received, you know, the appropriate shellacking, as President Obama used to call the midterm results, and it didn't happen that way. And so you have a whole lot of folks who are looking at CPAC as saying, maybe that bit of circus performance is not what we necessarily want to be part of anymore. So you will see some highlights from, you know, Trump when he's speaking there, but by and large, Republicans are trying to move on to, you know, other matters, other show places. One of those show places will actually be seen tonight in prime time, starring Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher, when the new House Committee on China has their first hearing. And they are going to, as I mentioned previously, they're going to try to put on an air of bipartisanship. And there is bipartisan concern about China, certainly because of the recent incident with the Chinese spy balloon that needed to be shot down. But as I've mentioned before, even as folks look into the spine, even as people look into reports of where did the coronavirus originate? Did it come from a market? Did it come from a lab? Are we never going to know? As we talk about trade issues and human rights issues, again, a lot of the focus is going to be on military issues and on Taiwan, for example. And I would like for this committee to be a complement to American foreign policy towards China, to show that Americans are united in ways to prevent China from bullying and violating human rights and things like that. I just have that concern based on the rhetoric of Congressman Gallagher from Green Bay that there's going to be more saber rattling than diplomacy. But the first act of that play opens up this evening in prime time, and we'll have a review a little later on. Let's take a break and then hear from Jim Obergefell coming up next. You're up north. All right, now excerpts from an interview with Jim Obergefell conducted last week as part of a podcast produced by the Minocqua Brewing Company, where I took part along with Kirk Bangstead and Kristen Lyerly. We started by asking Jim to summarize how Obergefell v. Hodges got started.
It comes down to this. My partner of almost 21 years, John, was dying of ALS. And we had always wanted to get married, but we lived in Ohio where that wasn't possible. And then when the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act with their decision in United States versus Windsor, I proposed. And we got married inside a chartered medical jet in Maryland, flew home to Ohio. Then we were introduced to a civil rights attorney who said, "Do you guys get it? When John dies, his last official record as a person will be wrong, because Ohio, on his death certificate where it says marital status, they will enter unmarried. And Jim, your name will not be there where it says surviving spouse." It made us angry and it broke our hearts. So that's how we started our case. And then it became known as Obergefell v. Hodges just by virtue of timing. I still remember sitting in that courtroom listening to Justice Kennedy read his decision. And as he began, my initial reaction was, well, we won. But then he kept reading, and legal writing isn't always incredibly clear to those of us who aren't attorneys. So I found myself wondering, well, did we win? But then it sunk in that, yes, we did. And like people around the courtroom, I burst into tears. And not surprisingly, my first thought was of my late husband, John, wishing that he could be there, wishing that he could know that our marriage could never be erased. And then what surprised me was the realization that for the first time in my life as an out gay man, I felt like an equal American.
And that's really that whole notion of equality for people who are ordinary Americans, who are living their lives, who want a name of that special person on a marriage license, want that surviving spouse on a death certificate. And similarly, again, the two big cases, you know, that we're talking about are yours. And then, of course, the Dobbs decision, which struck down Roe v. Wade, which now has women around the country feeling like second-class citizens. And Clarence Thomas, of all people, said, "We need to be going back and looking at some of these other cases that we thought were settled law. We thought settled the matter of privacy for Americans." That Clarence Thomas opinion in the Dobbs decision, that had to be such a gut punch.
It absolutely was. I mean, first off, the Dobbs decision is a gut punch for anyone in this country who believes we deserve and have the right to make decisions about our own bodies without government interference. So that was a terrible decision for our nation, not to mention women and anyone who's pregnant losing their right to make those choices. But then to have Justice Thomas put a target on marriage equality, on the right to intimate relations and the privacy of your own home, and the right to birth control in his concurring opinion, it's despicable.
So since that time, there has been an effort to codify marriage rights into federal statute, because this Supreme Court has taught us that, well, that they're now adjudicated liars. They had said that Roe was settled law, and they talked about stare decisis, and that they would not go back and overturn things. And so the rights that were protected by Supreme Court decisions had the force of law. But when we see how easily politicians in robes can now strip away those things when they don't agree with them any longer. It's time to put those things into statute. And Senator Tammy Baldwin was among those leaders to have marriage equality codified into law, something, Jim, that I'm sure you thought was well overdue, but definitely something that had to be done.
Well, I'm of the mind that it angers me that it had to be done, period. And this goes back to your comments about the Supreme Court. They are supposed to protect precedents. They are supposed to make decisions based on precedents. They are not supposed to, because of their personal religious beliefs, because in my opinion, this is clearly based on their religious beliefs, not law, their religious beliefs, which is the same reason they're opposed to marriage equality, their religion. It's just, I'm angry that it had to happen, that we have to fight to put these rights into law, because we shouldn't have to when the Supreme Court has ruled. Now, the Respect for Marriage Act, I'm not a fan. Number one, I think it's misnamed. It does not respect us or our marriages. It does not respect our rights as citizens of this country to get married. Sure, I'm happy it's there as a backstop should the Supreme Court overturn Obergefell. But all the Respect for Marriage Act does is say that all states must recognize same-sex marriages from other states. We can go back to a world where a couple, let's say there's a couple here in Ohio where I live, a same-sex couple. Ohio's one of the many states that still has a state-level Defense of Marriage Act on the books. If Obergefell is overturned, the state could immediately decide to stop issuing marriage licenses to those same-sex couples. It is not equality and it is not respect to tell a same-sex couple they have to go to another state.
I have to imagine that as you took on this journey, you had no idea that you would end up having a last name that has a life of its own. I mean, let's be honest, you were just trying to do the right thing and then you found yourself in this place and like, here you are. You're kind of a legend, Jim.
it's surreal. It's bizarre. It still doesn't feel normal to me to hear or see my name used over and over again as shorthand for marriage equality. It doesn't seem possible. There are times I have to remind myself that they're actually talking about me, because it just doesn't seem like this could be my life. But I always just come back to the fact that we started this lawsuit and we continued the fight, and I continued the fight after John died, because it was simply the right thing to do. John and I deserve to exist in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the government of Ohio, just like any other couple. It was the right thing to do. But yeah, it's really strange to have my name on a Supreme Court decision. And I like to joke that I've done a really good deed for all future Obergefells, because more people will know how to pronounce that name.
There's a big election in April, but we have a lot of hope, and a lot of people listening right now have a lot of hope. What would you say to them in terms of your activism and how they can be more active? I mean, you're a guy that's been trying to help protect people like you, the LGBTQ plus community, for a long time. What can you say to some of these people?
You know, I will bring it down to this. I'm a white cisgender gay man, and I have no right to ask for my equality, to demand equality for myself, if I'm not also fighting for and demanding that for every other marginalized community in this nation. We are all part of We the People, and we have got to believe it, and fight for it. Because if we don't, it's clear what's going to happen. Many of us are going to be and have been excluded from We the People. And there are a lot of people in this country who want that and are more than happy to exclude others because they think it makes them feel safer. We have got to use our voice at the ballot box every single election.
So Jim, tell us, what happened after this case?
The simple thing to say is my life changed completely. I was never an activist. Neither John nor I were activists. But I found during the course of this case and of fighting for marriage equality and fighting for my husband, I discovered that there was an activist inside me, and I just needed to let that activist out. And I have to say it was easy because fighting for your loved one, fighting for the most important person in your world, fighting for your relationship to exist was a really easy motivator, really good motivator. But I realized I had to keep fighting because even with that decision on June 26, 2015, we still haven't enjoyed marriage equality. We have the right to get a marriage license and to get married in all 50 states. But all I have to do is mention Kim Davis, Masterpiece Bake Shop. There, in so many ways, we do not enjoy marriage equality. So I knew even at that point that I had to continue being involved, continued fighting. So I did. I've embraced the life of an activist. I left Cincinnati, where I'd lived for 30-some years. John's and my entire 21 years together was in Cincinnati. And I moved to Washington, D.C. And part of that was, I'll be honest, I saw the ghost of John in too many places around Cincinnati. I couldn't take it. But I also was becoming more active, more politically involved. So D.C. was a good spot to go. And I really enjoyed being in D.C. in the nation's capital. But I joined the board of SAGE, which advocates for older LGBTQ plus people. I'm on the advisory boards for the Mattachine Society of Washington, D.C., which does archive activism. I'm on the advisory board for the GLBT Historical Society. I'm on the board of WebQ. I was a staff member at Family Equality, an organization that advocates for queer families and queer people who want to form families. I have to keep fighting. I really do. And it's just part of who I am now. I can't keep quiet. And as I mentioned earlier, I have to keep fighting for all marginalized communities, not just white gay men. I'm fighting for everyone. And I think of our transgender community and the attacks they endure every single day, the way they're demeaned and demonized across our nation. That's I can't imagine being a trans person in our nation right now. But also, when is this country ever going to get rid of the cancer that is racism? There's so much that we need to do in this country to live up to what we say America, what the United States is about. So I'll keep fighting any way I can. Use my voice, use my time, use my energy to really help make this a better place.
There are so many ways that you can do that too. And your story, yours and John's story, reminds me so much of a dear friend of mine here in Green Bay who lost his partner a few years ago and has been able to turn some of his energy into a wonderful fund, the Canary Fund, that supports nonprofits in our area. I reached out to him, Pete Angelillo, I think he's watching tonight, and he had a question he wanted me to share with you. So if you'll indulge me.
Absolutely.
Pete asked, I've been wondering lately about the good trouble that many of us are involved in, where we may not see the benefits of that work in our lifetimes. Was it difficult for you at times to continue your work of securing marriage rights for all when you might not see that day come before John passed? And what carried you forward on those days?
You know, there were certainly times when it was difficult to keep fighting, especially after John died. I mean, I can say at least we won our first hearing in federal district court 3 months to the day before John died. So we had 3 months where we knew our marriage had to be recognized by the state of Ohio, and John died a married man. But there were certainly times after that where it was difficult to keep going, but I knew I had to for a couple reasons. Number one, I promised John to love, honor, and protect him. And the only way I could do that was to keep fighting for our marriage to exist, for us to exist. But it was also that realization that I was part of a movement to make the world better for people who come after me. And I know I'm in debt to people like Edie Windsor, Frank Kameny, Marsha P. Johnson, so many people who came before me and were part of a fight that made my life as a closeted gay kid easier than it was for them 20, 30, 40 years before. So there was never any doubt in my mind that I would keep fighting because I was doing it not just for John and me, I was doing it to make the world a better place for others. And that's what keeps me going. That's what I have to keep fighting for, because And I'll share this because this, to me, this just really encapsulates why I keep fighting. I spoke at the University of Tennessee last year, and after I finished, a young woman came up to me and she said, "Jim, I just want you to know, if it weren't for marriage equality, I would have committed suicide." I don't think many people would say, "Oh, a lawsuit is something that would save someone's life." But it did. And I know she isn't the only one. So for me, that's why I keep fighting. That's why I keep getting involved in good trouble, because I owe it to the people who come after me. I want their lives, I want their world to be better than what I grew up in.
Jim Obergefell, interviewed last week on a podcast produced by the Minocqua Brewing Company. For the full program, go to the Minocqua Brewing Company Facebook page, scroll down a few posts, and look for the original live broadcast from last Wednesday. We'll be right back. You're up north.
As the world goes round.
There you are, lovers hail the moonlight cocktail.
Oh, we're going way back for today's music break to find out what was the number one song on this particular day in history, February 28th, 1942. So we're still in the early weeks of America's involvement in the Second World War, and the number one song was Moonlight Cocktail by Glenn Miller. Hit number one and would stay that way for 10 weeks. And as I'm listening to this, I caught the lyrics and I looked them up and I thought, that's a very nicely written little ditty there. The Moonlight Cocktail lyrics include a couple of jiggers of moonlight and add a star, pour in the blue of a June night and one guitar, mix in a couple of dreamers and there you are, lovers hail the moonlight cocktail. So you're not going to get that from Eminem necessarily, although I'd love to. I'm serious, Aaron. I would love if there were more of today's artists, rap and otherwise, that went back and grabbed some lyrics and put them into something more appropriate for what people like to listen to today, because there was great writing back then. It's just that you're not going to hear the Glenn Miller Orchestra necessarily. I'd rather hear how it would sound today, and there's some great writing out there.
Although the Marshall Mathers Orchestra would also be pretty interesting if he just literally did a cover of this, but
I would like to hear that. I seriously would. Also on this day, it was February 28th, 1983, the final episode of MASH, Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, aired on CBS. We talked about this a couple of weeks back when talking about Super Bowl ratings, and the most highly rated TV programs, you know, the top 10 are all Super Bowls, except for this final episode of MASH, which had 121.5 million viewers. All right, speaking of music closer to today's era, here was the number one song from 2004.
Peace up, A-Town Down.
Yeah,
So that's Usher, of course. Ludacris, Little John hit number one on this day, and this one stayed number one for 12 weeks. It was the biggest hit of 2004. Frankly, it'd still be one of the biggest hits today if it got released. It's that good. This day in 1967, Pink Floyd got their first record deal with EMI Records. On this day in 1984, Michael Jackson won 8 Grammys, including Album of the Year for Thriller. And one birthday from the country music world, Jason Aldean is 46 years old today. All right, we just talked about the biggest hit of 2004. On this day, the number one hit of 1970 would become the biggest hit of that year. Which really tells you something about the difference between 1970 versus 2004. But that was Simon and Garfunkel topping the chart, and it would be number one for 6 weeks, and again be the biggest song of 1970. On this day in 1995, Jewel made her debut with an album, Pieces of You, that was released. In 1983, U2 released their third album, War, which was their first to sell over 1 million copies in the U.S., including this song. On this day in 2006, Ne-Yo's first album, In My Own Words, debuted at number one on the album charts. On this day in 2009, Flo Rida's Right Round began a six-week run at number one, featuring the then-unknown singer Kesha Siebert, who we now know simply as Kesha. And also on this day in 2013, Pope Benedict XVI resigned, becoming the first pope to resign in office since 1415. And Pope Benedict recently passed away. So there's your little music break and history lesson for this Tuesday, February 28th. We're going to talk a bit more about this in the next hour, but the Supreme Court is going to be hearing arguments today about student loan debt and President Biden's plan for forgiving student loan debt. So we'll go over some of the arguments for and against that and get your take on that. We do have quick time for any phone comments about that, or the other topic that we brought up earlier in the hour that we're also going to talk about next hour. Can you use milk for all of these other non-milk beverages, oat milk and soy milk, almond milk, what have you? Is that okay? Do we all understand, you know, milk versus milk, or is that just wrong to basically you're using like the word juice in a way that it's not what it really is? And the FDA has put out some guidance on that. So we'll talk about that with Hans Breitenmoser in the next hour. If you have comments on that or anything else in the news so far, 844-967-2789, or the Up North line is 715-388-3888. 7155. We also read your emails that you send to radio at upnorthnewswi.com. And it is at upnorthnewswi.com that you can get all the latest stories that the team at Up North News is working on these days. We talked about the Girl Scout cookie story that recently went up, where you can get them, and then asking about, you know, what's your favorite flavor, what new ones would you come up with? But there are plenty of other stories that have gone up most recently about everything from, you know, the biggest majors in the University of Wisconsin system right now, to a story about dairy farming and how the average dairy farm has only turned a profit twice in the past 20 years. We have numerous stories about the Supreme Court race coming up. And things like, you know, nearly 60,000 Wisconsin seniors on Medicare need insulin. So we ask, why do Republicans continue to oppose the $35 a month insulin cap that was proposed by President Biden, as well as Governor Evers, as well as other Democrats? So you will find all of that and more over at upnorthnewswi.com, and look for Up North News WI on social media if you want to find the stories that we're covering as well. There's also going to be we talked about the China committee that's going to get its work started tonight. There's another committee in the House of Representatives, now controlled by Republicans, that is equally concerning in that it could provide good investigatory powers. It could shine a light on things. It could lead to good policy, or it could be used purely for politics and frankly exacerbate divisions in this country. And the other certainly sits with this new committee that's going to quote unquote investigate the COVID-19 pandemic and its origins. And while we're not going to get big into the committee here in this final minute from this 6 o'clock hour, I do want to again remind folks, as they're listening to press reports about this new report from the U.S. Energy Department about the pandemic, quote unquote, likely originating from a laboratory leak. Again, likely seems like a weird word to use when they also say they have low confidence in that assessment. So they make an assessment, but they also say we have very low confidence. They are hedging their bets like you can't believe that. They're saying, I would not put money on this, but here's our best guess. And so I would caution again about people taking that as gospel. We don't know. I hope this committee can help shine a light on it. I don't, again, I wouldn't put money on it. Back with more in our next hour. You're up north.